Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's entertaining and accessible. If we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. I'm here with my co-host, John Wells. Today in the program, we'll speak with staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the book, The Sixth Extinction, Elizabeth Colbert. Our planet has endured five extinctions, the last of which was the one that obliterated the dinosaurs and many other species when an asteroid collided with Earth. Now we're in what she calls the sixth extinction. It's according to Colbert and also scores of scientists who she has meticulously researched. We'll speak with her in the first half of the hour.
And good morning, Lynn. Our second guest, Daniel Suarez, isn't your average science fiction writer. At least we don't think so. He's the new Michael Crichton, and that's what critics are calling him. He's a former IT guy turned writer, and he's brought a new science fiction book, Influx, which brings us to a world in which decades of technological advances have been suppressed in an effort to prevent disruptive change. Are smartphones really humanity's most significant innovation since the moon landings? Or can something else explain why the bold visions of the 20th century, fusion power, genetic enhancements, artificial intelligence, cures for common diseases, extended human life, and all these other world-changing advances, why have they remained beyond our grasp? Well, Daniel Suarez will join us in the second half of the show.
And I can't wait to talk to him. He's one interesting guy.
Sure is.
All that plus today's cool story after these words. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801. PeakArtAndFrame.com.
Jan, guess who?
What?
What do you mean, what?
Wait, what's going on?
When?
When? Or where?
Well, where do you think?
About what?
Huh?
Questioning your weekend plans?
Find out what to do, where to go, who to see.
And who's on first this fun Friday.
Clearly brought to you by
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
Homestead Resort,
Foothill Oriental Rugs,
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery,
Summit County Business Directory.
Why, it's simple.
Tune in.
Tuna.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Well, our first guest is Elizabeth Colbert. She's traveled the world with leading scientists to peruse the science behind the sixth extinction, which she says we're in right now, from the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where the coral reef and myriad marine species are in decline, to the bubbly waters of an Italian sea, where naturally occurring CO2 can show us what's happening to our marine life. And our water from the Arctic Ocean, where glaciers are disappearing at an alarming rate. Well, with an alarming and catastrophic rate of obliteration of many species, Colbert explains how half of all species could be gone by the end of the century. Her book's been getting a lot of buzz, and Colbert is also the author of the popular book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and now she's joining us to talk about this new book, The Sixth Extinction. And Elizabeth Colbert, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I guess I want to bring up the interview that I witnessed on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And it struck me as interesting because it was almost, I mean, he's so humorous, but it was as though we were talking about a humorous book when in reality, the sixth extinction is sort of a dire book. But you do try to look at it in this light way, and I don't know why he was bringing humor into it. But enlighten us on that.
Well, as you suggest, you know, Jon Stewart brings humor to everything, even, you know, the most calamitous subjects. And in a way, I guess it was appropriate because, as you say, it's a very, very serious subject. I think I would argue there really couldn't be a more serious subject, but I do try to write it. I don't, I think you need to engage readers in any subject, and I did try to write the book in a way that was engaging and on occasion even humorous.
Right. And you do a great job of it, and I think that's why the book is so engaging and accessible for those of us who are not scientists. So kudos on that. But let's get into basically over the last half billion years, there have been five major mass extinctions. Of course, the one that we, I think, readily know about as lay people is the fifth extinction, which was the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. But can you quickly go through what one thing it was through all of the extinctions?
Well, that's a very interesting point you make, or sort of question, because it was not one thing, and there's an interesting history there, which I do recount in the book, which is that after people realized, and there is a pretty broad consensus now, that it was an asteroid impact that did not just the dinosaurs, but a lot of other groups, the plesiosaurs, the pterosaurs, the ammonites, many, many groups went out in this extinction event 66 million years ago. So after they realized that, which is not that long ago, back in the 80s and 90s, people went out and looked at all of these other junctures where they saw that they're in the fossil record, where they saw there were major extinction events. They went back and said, well, maybe an asteroid caused all of them. That would be a very elegant, solution to this scientific puzzle. But they couldn't find evidence for an asteroid impact at any of the others, really. So people are still looking. These are cold cases, that go back hundreds of millions of years. And we have to try to look at very, very subtle clues that are left after hundreds of millions of years. But, for example, it's believed now, the best evidence seems to point to the idea that the first of these five major mass extinctions was caused by a sudden cold snap, a glaciation of the planet, and that the third, which was the worst of all mass extinctions, it occurred about 250 million years ago. It's sometimes called the mother of mass extinctions. That was caused by the opposite, by a very sudden and severe global warming event, massive release of carbon dioxide, acidification of the oceans accompanied that. That's one of the other effects of a massive release of CO2. One of the very sobering points that scientists make now is that, what we are doing is analogous to what seems to have happened at that moment of this very terrible mass extinction, which is that we are pouring lots and lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Exactly. And Elizabeth, the fifth extinction 65 million years ago, I believe around approximately three-quarters of the species on Earth were taken out. Is that correct?
Yes, and people think, it's popularly sort of portrayed as this really bad, day for the dinosaurs, and goodness knows it certainly was a bad day for the dinosaurs, but it was also a very bad day for most mammals. Most mammals did not make it through that extinction event. And all the mammals that we know today are obviously the descendants of those, relatively few species that did make it through. Most birds did not make it through. So it was a very widespread phenomenon. And in fact, one of the hallmarks of mass extinction events is that they affect many different groups, not just one.
And I wanted to compare that to the third extinction you were talking about that occurred 250 million years ago. We lost almost all species, if not all.
Yes, that was a terrible extinction, as I say. It's sometimes also referred to as the Great Dying, something like, once again, these are pretty rough figures, but something like 90% of all species on the planet seem to have been lost. And some people say it came perilously close to wiping out multicellular life altogether, so really setting the evolutionary clock back, to the point where the planet only supported unicellular life. That did not quite happen, but it came frighteningly close.
Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you, coming back out here to the future, we certainly all know about climate change and carbon dioxide levels, which are probably the highest in 800,000 years. I've read in your book, and I've heard that reported by other sources, population growth, these sorts of things. But I really don't know a lot about the ocean acidification, where since 1800 you report acidification in the oceans is up 30%, and by the end of the century, it could be as high as 150%, which would basically kill the entire marine food chain. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, ocean acidification is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, and many scientists would say it's actually its more evil twin. So ocean acidification refers to the fact that when we put carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere, as we are doing all the time by burning fossil fuels, driving our cars around, producing electricity by burning coal, all of those activities that seem to us pretty ordinary. We are also pumping a lot of carbon dioxide into the water, and that is just because water covers so much of the surface of the Earth. The oceans cover 70% of the surface of the Earth, and wherever you have this boundary between the water and the air, they exchange gases. So whatever you put up into the air, a lot of it ends up in the oceans. And in the case of CO2, about a third of it is ending up in the oceans very, very rapidly. And when you dissolve CO2 in water, it forms an acid. It's called carbonic acid. It's a weak acid. We drink it. If you drink a carbonated drink, if you drink Coke, you're drinking it. But it's an acid. And so we're changing the chemistry of the oceans. We are reducing the pH of the oceans for those, who remember their high school chemistry. And this can have many, many ramifications. Researchers are really just beginning to try to figure out what the ramifications are. But one of the very serious ramifications that it seems to have is that corals, which are little tiny animals that build these huge and wonderful reefs. Everyone has seen pictures of coral reefs and the incredible array of life that they support, that corals have a hard time keeping up with ocean acidification. So one of the very, very stark projections for the coming century is that if we continue on this path of emitting carbon and acidifying the oceans, that by around the middle of this century, we will start to see, all the world's reefs start to collapse. And I should say reefs are already in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. The Great Barrier Reef has lost off Australia. That's the world's largest reef. And the Great Barrier Reef has lost almost half of its coral cover just in the last three decades or so.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Elizabeth Colbert. She's the author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. So, Elizabeth, one of the less dire components of your book is that you get to travel around the world doing research for this book for the last 4 years. And one of the places that you go, and also everywhere you go with the leading scientists to do the research and those who are really up on the most recent research. So talk about what you saw at the Great Barrier Reef when you went there and were able to walk out onto the reef during low tide, and then how it relates to humans. We're very self-centered at the end of the day. We want to know, how does that relate to us?
Yeah, one of the sort of paradoxes of writing this book was, as you indicate, I got to go to the most amazing places. I went out with scientists who were studying human impacts on the planet, and one of the points that I make is, you can find human impacts anywhere on the planet now if you know what you're looking for. But but these scientists were going to some of the, relatively speaking, most untouched places on the planet, and I was very lucky to go with them. And one group of scientists I went out with, we went out on the Great Barrier Reef, and they were collecting water samples, and we would walk across what's called a reef flat, which is just a very flat part of the reef. It's the reef grows up to the water level at low tide, and then it has a surface not like a table, but sort of like a bunch of tables, and you can sort of jump from one table to the other. And we would go out during the day and at night, and it was fantastically beautiful. And at low tide, there were all of these creatures are sort of waiting out, waiting for high tide to come back. So we saw, these amazing turtles and octopuses, and little sharks are waiting it out. And there are these great giant clams on the Great Barrier Reef that have these sort of, they look like lips, and they're filled with these algae, actually, that are really colorful symbiotic algae, and so they seem to be sort of leering up at you with these really garishly painted lips. So it's just an incredible a ray of light there. It was just fantastically beautiful. And then to your question of, you know, how does this affect us? I think there are two ways to answer that question. You know, one is just a somewhat abstract, but I think for that reason no less important answer, is that this is the beauty and the variety of the world that we're talking about here, and it's unraveling pretty quickly at this point. And that is something that, you know, affects all of us, I would argue, whether we sort of are immediately aware of it or not. And the other way, I guess I would say, it affects us or potentially affects us is that one of the things and one of the points of writing the book is that, you know, at this moment, at these moments of mass extinction, it's been posited that sort of the rules of the game change. And when the rules of the game change, the rules of the survival game change, you don't know exactly what's going to happen. So when we are putting a lot of other creatures at risk, which pretty clearly are right now, you know, you would also argue we're putting our food web at risk and ultimately putting ourselves at risk.
And there needs to be an economic argument to really grab people's attention. And when I think about sharing the earth with other creatures, I'm trying to think what economic argument could possibly show up.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that you're making. And people have, you know, tried to sort of value what are sometimes called ecosystem services, the air we breathe, the water we drink, you know, the whole underlying ecosystems, pollinators that support the crops we eat. But it's hard to put numbers on breathing air, you know, and it's hard to put numbers on water. So these are hard to quantify. And I can't say that it seems to have succeeded so far, at least. But on some level, what you have is this situation where we take a lot of things for granted that are, you know, what might be called ecosystem services, where we're not paying for them. They're just sort of there until they're not. And that's the worry.
Yeah. Our guest is Elizabeth Colbert. She's the author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. In The Sixth Extinction, and by the way, I want to point out that this isn't your conjuring up. This is something that you've heard from scientists along the way. Isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. If you read the scientific literature, you will see, you know, many, many references to what is often called the current mass extinction. And The Sixth Extinction is not a term that I came up with by any, you know, stretch of the imagination. Is a term very much in circulation.
Right. And can you predict or can you say what scientists are regarding as, you know, how far through this extinction we are? You know, are we 10%? Are we halfway there?
Right. Some people would say we're, you know, really only on the verge of it, really. We can still prevent, you know, a mass extinction. And we're certainly nowhere near, if you look at the end Cretaceous extinction, which did in the dinosaurs and 3/4 of all species on Earth. Obviously, we're nowhere near, you know, doing in 3/4 of all species on Earth yet. But the very, you know, worrisome thing is that when people sort of modeling and projections, and all this is admittedly speculative, and they try to look at the effects of climate change and ocean acidification and, you know, on and on, they get to figures that are pretty frighteningly high, you know, just looking through, for example, the end of this century, that we could potentially, you know, be committing up to, you know, half of all species on Earth to extinction. That wouldn't mean they were already extinct, but it would mean that the trajectory they were on was towards extinction. So unfortunately, there are a lot of time lags in the system. There's a lot of time lags to climate change. There's a lot of time lags to extinction. You know, it takes a long time for a species, even that's in very grave decline, to actually become extinct. We don't even declare a species extinct until it hasn't been seen for something like 50 years. So, you know, where are we in this process? Unfortunately, when you're living through something, it's very, very hard to say.
Mm-hmm. You know, it all moves so slowly.
The most hopeful thing would be we've still got time to avert it. Certainly, I would say we still have time to avert the worst of it. But, you know, how deep we are in, is very difficult to say.
We have a lot of people talking about it, so and I suspect that that more people will be talking about it. It's a fascinating book. It's very well researched. I'm curious, has Fox News reviewed this book yet?
No, I haven't. I was actually on Fox Radio. I did get asked invited on Fox Radio, but that's as far as we've gotten.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. And you know, when you provide that graph at the end of the book that shows a period of time of 500 million years, I was surprised. Yeah, Lynn had told me last week that we've only been around here for about 4,000 years.
I know. There is a little bit of a mismatch there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Elizabeth, I want to ask you quickly about amphibians, and they seem to be, as a species, some of the most resilient. I mean, some of the frogs are almost prehistoric, and they've been around a long time, but they are one of the groups that you're so concerned about, and scientists are, because they're disappearing. Talk a little bit about that. It shows that maybe this sixth extinction may be the mother of all extinctions after the third.
Yeah. I mean, amphibians have the very, very dubious distinction of being the most threatened class of animals right now. Something like 40% of all amphibian species are classified as endangered, threatened or endangered or extinct. Amphibians, as you say, are great survivors. They've been around for a really long time. They've been around since before there were dinosaurs. So it certainly is very worrying. And in fact, when amphibians started disappearing, people who studied them were really almost refused to believe it. They couldn't believe it because amphibians are, you know, ubiquitous. They're on every continent except Antarctica. They're as I say, they're survivors, and people couldn't really even believe that they were disappearing at this incredible rate, and were disappearing even from places that seemed pretty untouched. You know, that people really hadn't obviously altered or destroyed. And one of the factors in this extinction, a very key factor, appears to be a fungal disease, a fungus that was almost certainly transported around the world by people, not at all intentionally, unintentionally, but which is fatal to many, many species.
Oh, so interesting.
That's what got the golden frog, the fungal disease.
Yes, the Panamanian golden frog, which is a beautiful, beautiful frog, which I saw in Panama because scientists, that was a really interesting case where scientists realized that this fungus, when they finally figured out what was happening, they actually realized that this fungus was moving through Panama, and it was moving from west to east, and they went in and they snatched some of these Panamanian golden frogs, which are these really beautiful, bright yellow frogs with very, very sort of soulful eyes. They took them out of the forest, and they had nowhere to put them, actually, at the beginning. So these frogs, you know, quite literally had to stay in a hotel.
They had room service.
And then they built them a very secure, sort of a sterile environment so that they could keep this fungus at bay inside this facility. And they have been breeding these frogs for several generations now, but they can't go back outside because the fungal disease is still out there.
Hmm. Well, at the end of the day, all of your travels and research and now writing this book, are there any nuggets of hope that you see within an extinction?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I did in the course of writing the book is I went out with a lot of people who are, you know, super committed to, you know, preserving the diversity of life on the planet. And I think that in general, people, you know, do care about the other species with whom we share our home planet, what Rachel Carson called the problem of sharing the Earth with other creatures. And I think, you know, people are deeply troubled by extinction, will go to tremendous lengths, as I mentioned, you know, building this facility for the frogs. When they built the facility, when they put the frogs up in the hotel, people came from all around the world to help out because the frogs needed food. So people had to go out literally into the fields and catch bugs for them. And people gave of their time and their money to do that because they wanted to help. So I think there is a lot of feeling here and a lot of concern when people are aware. You know, the problem is, or a problem, one of the many problems, is that, you know, this is not a problem that can really be attacked sort of piecemeal, one species at a time. The problems are really, really big. They're global problems, and they sort of have to be approached in that fashion to really make a difference.
Our guest is Elizabeth Colbert. Her book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And thank you for reminding me of Rachel Carson, because I've read that your book is being compared in terms of its impact that it has to Rachel Carson's book from, what, the 1970s, Silent Spring.
Well, wow. Any writer would be, you know, flattered to yeah. be compared with Rachel Carson. I am flattered. I think that what Rachel Carson was writing about was something that was, pretty, in a sense, it was a very huge problem, but it had a pretty clear, a much clearer cause, and in some sense, even a clearer solution, and it caused tremendous change in our society. And, you know, the fact that we have, for example, bald eagles today is completely due to Rachel Carson and banning those pesticides that were causing bald eagles to reach, you know, really dangerously low numbers. And I just saw an eagle on the Hudson River recently, and it was a fantastic sight. And I personally, you know, thanked Rachel Carson for that. I don't in any way, you know, think that I'm going to be, you know, solving all the problems of the world, unfortunately.
You never know, Elizabeth. What is
well,
next for you?
You?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating book, as was Field Notes from a Catastrophe. What is next for you?
You know, that is such a good question. I don't know exactly how to follow this one up. I was sort of writing till the very, very end, till we were, you know, going off to press. So I have to regroup and figure that out.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Bye.
Okay, best of luck.
And again, that was Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And wow, that's an interesting, very interesting book. And this is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back with Daniel Suarez. He's the author of the book Influx. Very interesting science fiction writer. He has lots to talk about. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
River Horse on Main is a proud supporter of KPCW. River Horse on Main has been serving dinner nightly since 1987. Open nightly for dinner with live entertainment each evening. RiverHorseParkCity.com, 435-649-3536.
Good morning and welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest, Daniel Suarez, is bursting onto the science fiction scene with his book, Influx, out just a week and already gaining widespread critical acclaim. His bestseller, Damon, was on his debut and earned Suarez a hefty following, and critics are now calling him the next Michael Crichton. But he's an IT guy by trade, a database software developer who probably spent his time at his desk dreaming about the book he could write if only he could become a writer. At least that's what we picture him doing. But he's joining us now to tell him himself. Daniel Suarez, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Good morning. Now, Daniel, should I address you as Daniel or Leonid Zaris?
Yeah, that's my pen name. Yeah, Daniel is fine. But when I started out my writing career, I actually self-published that first book, Damon. And it was because at the time I had a very serious job, and I thought writing a book about hacking and sort of disrupting the world might not be a great idea with my real name when I have my arms elbow deep in somebody's network. So right. I used that pen name. But then later when the book came out and became a success, it was funny because it turned out that a number of my clients had novels of their own that they were writing. So they did not disown me.
Yeah. And how does it feel to be compared to Tom Clancy and Michael Crichton?
Yeah, it's a little surreal, actually. I try not to think about it because it seems kind of ridiculous. But I'm glad that people like my books. I just don't want to overthink it.
Right. And in your new book, Influx, it's a world in which decades of technological advances have been suppressed in an effort to prevent disruptive change. And cold fusion, cure for cancer, advanced robotics, and the protagonist, John Grady, has developed a gravity mirror. And I'm curious, of all the different technologies you could have picked for the protagonist, why did you pick a gravity mirror for him?
Well, gravity, you think about it, it permeates everything. It is also the only force that does not conform to classical physics. So basically, it is a force that we really essentially do not control or understand. It eludes us. And so I wanted to do, I mean, this is a force that can swallow whole galaxies, light itself. So that was obviously, I thought, the source for a very exciting epic tale about technology. If you could control gravity, well, that's power on a scale unimaginable.
And yet they call it the weak force.
Yes, it's interesting how that goes.
Yeah.
But, of course, there's all sorts of theories about why that might be, whether it's a force being exerted from a different dimension and whatnot, and I explore that in the book. But in its aggregate, gravity is the most powerful force there is. But close up, it's extremely weak, certainly a lot weaker than the atomic force that holds together, you know, atoms.
Right. I just want to mention, I didn't get much done this weekend. I had to finish your book. And if I didn't finish your book, I wasn't going to get any of my stuff done. But I'm a Crichton fan, and I hadn't read fiction in a while. And I really very much enjoyed your book.
Oh, I'm so glad. That's the goal. Because you probably noticed that a lot of the technology in there seems very realistic. And that's my goal. I try to make it very authentic and do a lot of research. But hopefully it was very accessible. Even non-technical readers.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about gravity, you're obviously fascinated by the subject, yet you would think that in a book, you're going to have your protagonist, you know, be a hacker or something like that, because your background is software development and, you know, you're an IT guy. So I think it's fascinating. You must have had to learn so much about gravity and physics in general. It's so well researched.
Oh, my gosh. Definitely I did. But, what I wanted to do, I have wide-ranging interests. You know, I grew up watching Cosmos with Carl Sagan, so I love science. And the idea, and of course, I love science fiction. So this is a more sci-fi book. I mean, my previous books were, I think, high-tech thrillers, cyber thrillers. But in this, I wanted to write this big epic tale about fusion and quantum computers and things. And, yes, it did require a great deal of research. I read a lot about string theory and theoretical physics. And for my gravity mirror, I actually met with a couple of JPL scientists, Jet Propulsion Lab scientists, to try to come up with a anti-gravity technology that is at least rooted in some reality, so that if you were a physicist, you should be able to read this book and still enjoy it.
Right. Okay, so this is what I find interesting about science fiction. I'm picturing all these very sciencey people who have, you know, who aren't exactly working on the right side of the brain. But, you know, you must be, because, well, you're creative, you're a writer. And I wonder how much creativity and maybe how creativity relates to innovation, and there's so much innovation needed in the sciences. How it all, I don't know, did you give those guys, the physicists at JPL, ideas about what they could do, do you think? Could you ever claim that?
I suppose there is a feedback loop, and I think what we do find, especially nowadays, we can find a number of examples, innovation comes from very unexpected sources. And a lot of times it comes from college dropouts, people who don't fit into the system, and they create a new system. And then other people rally around them. I think a lot of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and billionaires, for instance, are dropouts, basically. They're B and C students. And so that makes it very interesting. But I think when I was doing research for this with the JPL scientists, I would really push them in some ways, because of course they're engineers and scientists and they're very comfortable in facts. And when I would suggest something, they'd say, well, that's very improbable. And I would say, but there's a chance then, you mean. And so, like I said, I think I was pulling them out of their comfort zone and vice versa.
You know, as if Newtonian physics wasn't challenging enough, Now we stick a very, very small toe into the world of quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating. There's so much we don't know about it. I'm curious, what do you believe the prospects are for understanding gravity differently in the quantum world?
Well, for those who don't know, basically when you get down to a quantum level, standard physics breaks down. Things that are very unexpected and that we do not fully comprehend occur, and we can observe this. And I think that just makes it so fascinating. It's just the universe is even more fascinating than we suppose. And I think, again, with all of the people on this Earth, we have 7 billion people now. We don't know where the next Einstein or Galileo is going to come from, who's going to bring us to that next level and have a critical insight. That's why I tried to make my protagonist, John Grady, someone who looks at the universe very differently. And in his case, he has got a neurological disorder. It's called synesthesia. And this is a real disorder where people taste music or they hear numbers. It's basically a cross-wiring in the brain that causes people to use more of their brain when, let's say, doing math or appreciating music. And synesthetes are very accomplished in things like music and physics. So I wanted to have a character who literally looked at the universe differently and then give the reader a chance to look at the universe through that person's eyes. And I found that to be fascinating. Again, all the research for it.
Absolutely. And if general relativity is the large and the very far apart, and if quantum is the very small and close together, do you think that there will be a version of string theory that will be the great unifier?
Well, you know, I tell you, anybody who's interested in it, I read in particular, this was my foundational book for starting the research on this, was a book by Lisa Randall called Warped Passages.
I don't know about you,
but have you ever tried to understand string theory and then, like, sort of understand it for, like, 30 seconds, and then it'll just go right out of your head?
Exactly.
She wonderfully unified all that. And when you think of all of the research they've done for sort of a multidimensional universe, it is immensely compelling, it's fascinating, and I don't doubt that we'll have some really radical innovations as a result in the next century thing.
Huh. I've always wondered, all the different scientists we talk to on this show, John has a way of being able to understand. It must be because he has that Lisa Randall book on his bedstand.
I love that book.
That's good. Well, I know what you mean about, like, learning string theory for about 30 seconds and then it goes away.
That's right. You sort of understand it and then it's gone. It's
But, you know, that's interesting because, again, on this show, we talk to so many scientists, and I think that I can grasp a variety of different scientific disciplines for this hour that we're talking to them. And then about 2 hours later, it's gone again. So, but in order to write this book, you had to know a lot about it. You couldn't just have a 30-second cursory knowledge. What did you find was the most difficult thing? Obviously, you're fascinated by gravity and string theory, but what was the most difficult thing to grasp that you needed to write about?
Certainly quantum computing was tricky, and of course, this is another technology, as was fusion. So I would say both of those, and what was funny is, a couple of years ago, I toured this facility called the National Ignition Facility. Have you ever heard of this? One of the purposes of being a novelist is you call people up and say, hey, I want to check this place out. And it's this $4 billion facility at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory where they built the largest laser ever made by man. And then they built 191 copies of that. And they focused all of these lasers at a tiny little pea-sized, you know, piece of fuel. And then they fired them all at once to try to cause fusion to happen. And they've been doing this for a couple of years to try to get it. And just a few weeks ago, they got out more energy than they put into it.
Wow.
And this is a massive facility. It's very complicated. But again, I think doing the research to make these stories very realistic is so worth it because there's a lot of exciting things happening in science that I don't think you've heard of that. Had you heard that before?
Yes. We actually did a show on the promise of cold fusion, which is really no promise now, it appears. But I think what they did at Lawrence Livermore, correct me if I'm wrong, was a thermonuclear reaction so that it was not cold fusion. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's definitely not cold fusion because what they were creating was excessive, really, really high temperature. The idea is high pressure, and for a billionth of a second. So it's not a sustained fusion reaction. And this was a big change because, of course, you used to see these magnetic containment vessels for sustained fusion. What they were thinking is, we'll have fusion happen for a billionth of a second, and then we'll do it 10 times a second and create a turbine, basically an engine, fusion engine. So that's the plan there. So cold fusion is still still a chimera, but other forms of fusion, who knows?
Yeah.
So all of this excited me, and doing the research was, of course, immense fun. And I think if I have a brand, it's that I try to take realistic technology and make it very accessible for a non-technical reader. And by going through it, hopefully you pick some things up, but the whole story is hopefully thrilling as well.
Right. And, you know, is this going to inspire young readers, for example? My son's a first year at college, and he's way into physics. And after looking at your book, I thought, I have to send this to him. Do you think it inspires because you make it accessible?
Oh, I hope so, only because I certainly felt that way when I was young. Again, you know, I think of books like Cosmos and the science fiction that I read. It made me interested in science and technology. And those are very important things for society now. It's not like those are minor things. If we think going back 100 years ago, I think literacy was the big thing. And I think technological literacy and scientific literacy is the needed knowledge now. So I would hope so.
It's amazing the combination of curiosity and enthusiasm and what that can do. We recently spoke to some people that are involved in a robotics competition here in the state of Utah, and one of the young ladies who built a robot and competed, she got so jazzed, and she was not thinking this way before the competition, but she now wants to be an engineer. So I absolutely agree with you that books like your book and books like yours and maybe Cool Science Radio and maybe a whole bunch of other things are going to encourage people to get a little excited about this.
Oh, I would love that because again, a lot of the people that I meet, young people working in technology, they're very passionate about it. They work long hours, but it doesn't seem like work.
No, it doesn't.
Right. Now, wanted to go back to synesthesia because I've heard of it before. I'm a little bit familiar with it. And as you say, your protagonist, John Grady, has synesthesia, and that enables him to sort of accomplish some of the wonky things that he does. But you don't have synesthesia yourself, I'm expecting, but have you come across a lot of people in the sciences that do?
Well, not synesthesia, but certainly I've come across various people who have memories that are astounding. In particular, a gentleman that I met on an IT security project had a memory where he could look at a screen that was filled with code and then move to another machine and replicate it just from memory.
Whoa.
I mean, there are some very clever people in the world, and it's humbling. I think it goes to the heart of there's always somebody smarter and less smart than yourself. No matter how clever you feel, there's always somebody out there who's just that much smarter. And
yeah,
also different ways of thinking. I think that's the thing I've come around to over as the years have gone by, is people might not be smarter than you in some ways, but in other ways they might be, and how they approach problems. And that's what makes it so interesting to work with other people, is everybody's different. And everybody has their specialty.
This morning we're speaking with Daniel Suarez, who is the author of Influx. He also wrote a book named titled Damon, which was a New York Times bestseller. And I wanted to ask you, first let me tell our listeners, if you really want to see something interesting, Google TED Talks and Daniel Suarez. You did a fascinating TED Talk on lethal autonomy, remotely piloted drones as the prelude to lethal autonomy. Can you first define that and then tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. Lethal autonomy is a technical term for a machine that can make the decision to kill. Basically, it's algorithmic killing, examining sensor input, and deciding when to pull a trigger or to fire a missile. And that sounds very fictional, but of course, we have reached the point where that isn't fiction. And in that TED Talk, I gave an example of two Samsung auto sniper stations, which at the time were deployed in the DMZ between North and South Korea. And they weren't turned on, these capabilities. But these machines were capable of automatically detecting human beings and firing on them. And so, of course, we are in a world where 70 nations are developing combat drones of their own, and moving that capability into the air is a very real possibility. And so I did that TED Talk because I think these changes were happening so quickly that we were not having a public debate about whether that was a good idea.
Yeah. And I think you also spoke about the video surveillance that we are capturing with our zones and with our drones. 2004, 71 hours of video surveillance. 2011, over 300,000. And today, I mean, it's sort of exponentially increasing, isn't it?
Well, yeah. You look at surveillance not just on drones, but throughout society, it is creating so much footage that now algorithms need to examine the footage to tell us what to look at. And so, again, this also folds a whole other layer of these bots into it. So bots will be telling us what to look at, advising us, and again, in a combat context, advising us what to fire at. And the issue is you can speed it up by simply removing the human from the equation. And that's the big risk. That's the big danger. It's very efficient, but it's perhaps not a good idea. Now, in the case of drones, you were just talking about the amount of video footage currently, or at least in past years. There'd be one camera on a Predator or a Reaper drone. But they plan to put up to 64, 65 cameras independently operated on each drone. And this, you know, is an order of magnitude, that much more video. So visual intelligence algorithms will be examining these cameras.
How is this going to shape the way war is waged?
Well, I think the tempo of war, I think that's the big rush in war, for automating war, is to increase its tempo. And, of course, that's really where my concern lies because, you know, automating war, making it efficient and fast, certainly dictatorships and repressive societies won't think twice. They won't think about the human rights potential there, and it's whether we rush to match them in that. That's my big concern because I think once we do that, there's no easy way to step back from it.
You know, kind of going back to your book, Daniel, and the fact that we take John Grady and sort of sequester him, kidnap him, whatever, keep him squelched, I guess, and hiding innovation from the public. You know, how much do you figure that's going on now? How much are we being kept from all these technological advances that are there and they're real now, but we don't really know it?
Well, I really look at that metaphorically. Think of surveillance and the revelations we've had about surveillance. Those were very advanced technologies, some of which penetrated high-tech companies in Silicon Valley. That's how stealthy and penetrating they were, very advanced software systems. I wanted to take that rather wonky issue and turn it into a physical thing, a big epic tale about these big technologies. But I do think it relates to some of the things going on in society today, because technology really is used to wield power, and it's done invisibly. I mean, we think about the smartphones that we carry around and how much data they produce and where that data goes.
And
what that says about us. A few years back, MIT had a project called Reality Mining, in which they took 1,000 cell phones, and they did what's called geolocation. They tracked the movement of those cell phones for a month, and then they quickly put together an algorithm that allowed them to predict with 93% accuracy what any individual person was going to do next. Now, if you were to combine that level of data mining with, let's say, an automated weapon system, and this is a very powerful combination, certainly for a repressive society, it's especially powerful.
And if you could focus in on the right individuals, you could really disrupt the social networks.
Oh, absolutely, because these types of software, social network software, geolocation software, they can see who is a hub individual, who connects everyone else. And so it becomes a very pinpoint accuracy combat situation where instead of carpet bombing, you just get rid of one or two people and the entire social organization falls apart.
I just wanted to mention the antagonist quickly because it ties into this. Hendrix, a.k.a. Dr. Evil, he had trouble containing technology. Once he stole it, he couldn't hold on to it. And, I mean, metaphorically, I look at that as being true as well. It's going to be hard for the major nations who might be able to control the technology to be able to hold on to it.
But still, look at, to me, I think embracing change and free exchange of ideas is the answer. And
sure,
you're right, technology is going to spread. But that has always been, I think, our strength, our ability to adapt and have an open society, not to try to retrench and to protect ourselves, some perception that we'll get security from that. I again, an illusion. And in the case of our hero being in prison with other Einsteins and Galileos of the 21st century, it's very difficult to contain people like that and to contain powerful ideas.
Fascinating. Well, Daniel, final question. I don't know if you heard our intro, but we pictured that all those years as a software developer and an IT guy, you were just sitting at your desk dreaming of the book that you would one day write once into your 40s. Is that true?
Well, you know, I do have an English literature degree.
Oh. Okay.
So I would say that early on I tried to write a novel, wasn't with it, and then I went into software and got very busy for 20 years.
Yeah.
At some point, I was trying to think of the issues I was concerned about in terms of how we were building a modern society. And I thought, well, I'm not going to write a white paper or an essay because nobody's going to read that.
And yeah.
I thought, oh, I'm going to try to write a tech thriller. And it worked out.
It sure did.
We want to thank you for your time this morning, Daniel. We also want to invite you to Park City, Utah, and to come into our studios and to sit down and talk to us about technology. We've really enjoyed this conversation this morning, and your book, Influx, again, Daniel Suarez, fascinating book.
Oh, great fun, guys. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Daniel.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we want to thank our guests this morning, of course, Daniel Suarez, author of Influx, and also Elizabeth Colbert, who is the author of Sixth Extinctions. We're going to be talking or hearing from some underwriters. We'll be back in a moment.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Well, thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. I want to thank our producer Beth Fratkin, also our underwriters today, Peak Art and Frame, Prudential Utah Real Estate.
And I wanted to mention very quickly, without going into any details, that Apple has a serious security issue. If you have an iPhone 5 and you are prompted to update to a newer version of the software, we would recommend it.
That's right. Just heard about that. Also, San Francisco Design. Sorry, I was... Thanks to San Francisco Design for underwriting our show. Just one more brief mention. Did you hear yesterday on national news about the discovery by NASA of 715 new planets, by far the biggest batch of planets ever unveiled at once?
Fascinating. And what I read was that many of these solar systems have planets that are the size between Neptune and Saturn and our Earth, and we don't have any planets in that size, but we might be an unusual solar system.
Interesting. I hear real estate's cheap there.
Mm.
On some of them anyway.
Right.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for National Public Radio News.